Welcome to the Bitcoin Infinity Academy, brought to you by the Plan B Network and Bitbox. This is the course on my first book, Sovereignty Through Mathematics, and I'm Knut Svanholm. I'm here, as always, with Luke De Wolf, and the chapter today is called Changing the Rules. How are you today, Luke?
I'm great, Knut, and glad to be doing this. Changing the Rules chapter is quite topical for a few reasons, so we might get into a little bit more of stuff that's relevant just today, but let's see.
Shall we just get into it and see what, if this leads to discussions about current topics or discussions about timeless topics, which is sort of what the Academy is supposed to be about, like timeless topics, I think.
Supposed to be, but we'll see how timeless this particular moment in time ends up being. Just before we do that, a quick reminder, if you're listening, the best way to get involved with the show and to support us, if you like, is to join the Academy. All the information on that is at our Geyser page, geyser.fund/project/infinity. And yeah, that's how you can get involved, have access to the Telegram chat, join the episodes live while we're recording them and ask us questions. And plenty of other things. All the details are there. So with that, shall we just dive in?
Yeah, let's upgrade the Academy through a soft fork or hard fork here. Let's see what happens.
Perfect. Changing the rules. Altering the Bitcoin protocol is easy. The code is open source, which means that anyone can download a copy of the code and make whatever changes they want to it. Altering what the participants of the Bitcoin network view as the real deal, however, is hard. Really hard. Gaining their acceptance requires the proposed upgrade to be really good and really bulletproof in terms of not altering the game theoretical fundamentals that make following the rules beneficial to the miners. Upgrades to the protocol can be implemented via either a soft fork or a hard fork. A soft fork is a voluntary, backward-compatible upgrade. A hard fork requires every node in the network that wants to stay active to upgrade its software. Even a soft fork can be very controversial, and a great debate between proponents of different paths to scaling up the Bitcoin network in 2017 led to a portion of the network forking off and creating a new chain via a hard fork. Even though the proposed upgrade was implemented following the consensus rules, some participants weren't very happy with it. At this point in time, it is unlikely that Bitcoin will ever hard fork again, except to fix critical bugs. And with that, well, this is probably opening up loads of discussion points. Where do you want to start?
A whole can of worms here.
Yes.
Yes, this is saying a lot about stuff like soft forks and hard forks, and also alluding to the block size wars. There have been, like, we're in the midst of a civil war in Bitcoin right now, it seems. There have been two preceding wars. The first one is kind of unknown, the operaturn wars, where the operaturn feature was implemented. And the big one is, of course, the block size wars. The first one, the operaturn wars, is from back in 2014. So Bitcoin is a very different thing back then. We don't really have any proof that it is as decentralized as it claims to be until after. To me, I my belief in Bitcoin was sort of ironclad after the block size wars, which were never about block size really, but about control. So you had the TLDR on that is that you have all the biggest companies in Bitcoin, the miners and the exchanges and the payment providers. They all wanted a hard fork to increase the block size, to be able to accommodate more transactions. And it's been framed as a fight between small blockers and big blockers. But it was all about control, because what increasing the block size via a hard fork would have done is set a precedent that this kind of behavior is okay. And then it could have upgraded again and again and again, and the block size could have been infinitely big. A hard fork did happen, and an alternative currency called Bcash forked off. The biggest proponent of that was Roger Ver, but Fake Toshi, or Craig Stephen Wright, was also in on this thing. And it was worth up to like a fifth or even a fourth of a Bitcoin at one point, I think. So the thing that happens when a hard fork happens is that you, as the private key holder, you all of a sudden have both coins or both tokens, and so you can keep them both, or you can sell one for the other in hopes that that one will win the war. And like, because money is a winner take all game, and one of these things will just be forgotten about and go to zero over time. And but to me, it was obvious that the one fork that the users wanted, not the big conglomerates, was the one that was going to win the war. At least that's what I hoped. So I sold my Bitcoin Cash quickly. And like this is at the time when I'm trying to learn Bitcoin. So I actually wrote an article. It's the first article I wrote that took off and went sort of semi-viral, and it was about how to take control of your own private keys, because that wasn't very easy back in 2017. If you were using a custodial wallet, you sort of had to figure this stuff out. So I wrote an article about that. And had I not written that article, I don't know if this book would have existed, because that sort of fueled me to write more than I saw that I had a voice in this. So it's super, super interesting, all of it, that this is how it works. There are a lot of misconceptions about it. And I think we dive into those misconceptions in latter paragraphs. So maybe we should just go on here. And do you have any comments on the block size wars or this paragraph?
Yeah. First off, I'll just say, I think this is really good history to start. This is good education. There's plenty of good things, podcasts, books about the block size wars. And it's good to know the history. So certainly recommend that if you're listening and you haven't learned the history, that you go check that out. But yeah, I think one of the points here, anyone can make changes to the protocol here. That is in fact true. It's just about adoption. Who is going to adopt that change to the protocol? If you make changes on your own implementation of Bitcoin, only you are going to be running it. You have to convince other people to run it. And the users of the Bitcoin network are not likely to adopt that change. Not extremely likely. And even now, there's only one implementation of Bitcoin that holds the vast majority of the market share. There's one development team, and this is where changes to Bitcoin do take place in ways that don't require even a soft fork or a hard fork. Changes there happen on the level of basically the node client, and there are various settings that can be changed or added or implemented that don't require any actual forking to happen, so to say. It's just updating your node. And I prefer to just, we can circle back to that later, but I just want to set the stage here a little bit, if that's okay. If you have any specific
comments.
One
more thing to say about that is, like, most technical issues, technical changes to Bitcoin, like they don't have a real impact on the social contract or like the economics of Bitcoin, or at least the devs don't think it does. And this is where sort of where the heated debates start, where like the technical people don't really understand the economic arguments, and the economic side sometimes don't understand the technicals of it, and there's a discrepancy there, and it's very interesting to see how this whole thing unfolds.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think let's continue and let's take off layers of the onion as we go, or
yes,
something like
absolutely.
That. Absolutely. Let's continue. The internet is an ocean of misinformation, and more often than not, it is very difficult to navigate through it. The sheer amount of dishonesty in the so-called crypto space is really depressing and has very little, if anything, to do with sound money. Bitcoin does one thing and one thing only. It solves the Byzantine general's problem through its consensus rules. That's it. A problem most people have never even heard of. The Byzantine general's problem describes how hard it is to construct a network where the participants can come to a consensus on the true state of the network, without needing to know or trust any of the other participants. In other words, how to construct a network in such a way that no trust is required, while ensuring that information sent via the network is true. A blockchain by itself does not ensure decentralization. It is not the underlying technology behind Bitcoin in any way. Bitcoin is the underlying technology behind the blockchain hype, but saying that the blockchain is the key invention here is misguided at best. The anchor chain is not the underlying technology behind the anchor, nor is the key chain the technology behind the key, or the food chain the underlying most interesting aspect of a human being. Be very skeptical of those promoting blockchains that do not see Bitcoin's blockchain as the most important one. Even social networks with billions of users, they are practically saying that masturbation is the most important aspect of sex. Okay, interesting one, and a little bit of a side topic here, I think.
Yeah, it's a bit of a side topic. I mean, the whole thing here is that everything in Bitcoin is voluntary, including what you define as Bitcoin. So like in that sense, the shitcoins have a purpose. Like because you cannot stop anyone from calling something Bitcoin or calling something an alternative for the Bitcoin or what. Like this is something that people, it's an agreement on a fixed set of rules. That's all it is. And if everyone agrees that that's something, then that something will happen. The whole thing is, though, set up in such a way that there can be only one, basically. Only one chain can be absolutely finite in its supply. There's a finite amount of Bitcoins and an infinite amount of shitcoins. That's like sort of all you need to know in this when choosing the correct chain or the chain that will that is most likely to store value over time or function as a medium of exchange over time. That's the correct way of saying that.
Yeah, and well, just a little bit about blockchain itself. I think it was actually a very good point that blockchain wasn't actually really the thing that was the innovation. It was blockchain plus a whole bunch of other things. And the idea of appending the block onto each other one is an interesting take, basically. Having to verify the entire chain every time is a big part of the solution, essentially. But then people misunderstood that the blockchain was the most important thing. And that wasn't it. You don't need to use a blockchain for everything.
No.
Blockchain is very, very inefficient method of data collation or whatever it is.
Yeah, and it's not necessary for any other use case than money because, like, none of the other use cases actually require decentralization or is better off because of it. Because, like, if you have, there was talk in 2017 about bananas on the blockchain and all of this stuff that you could attach something in the physical world to, and say that this is one unit of that and this is attached to that blockchain and whatnot. But the whole security model breaks down as soon as you make that connection because this is only secure, within its own borders. It's self-referencing all the time. The Satoshi is valuable because it's a part of this bigger thing and not just something that you can attach to other stuff. You can exchange it for other stuff, but you can't like connect it to the outer world and expect the security model to be the same. So there's a lot to be said about this, but and I think we will in later paragraphs here, so maybe we should move on.
Yeah, let's continue. At any point in time, any participant in the Bitcoin network can stop agreeing with the network's way of determining scarcity and coming to consensus. A participant can choose to follow a hard fork of Bitcoin, exchange all of their Bitcoin for another cryptocurrency, or abandon the idea of digital scarcity altogether if they so choose. What they can't do is change Bitcoin, change what others perceive to be Bitcoin, or change the nature of how Bitcoiners determine scarcity. Unlike every government-backed currency, no one is forcing anyone to agree with anything in Bitcoin. It is a completely voluntary system with no formal leaders. We humans aren't used to leaderless systems, and the idea of having no authority telling us how to think about it is scary to a lot of people. As mentioned above, Many opportunists take advantage of this, and many people will lose money to scammers before Bitcoin finds its rightful place in our society. Stay vigilant and be suspicious of any cryptocurrency, so-called, that isn't Bitcoin. Every claim that an alternative currency has a new feature, is better for the environment, is faster or more anonymous than Bitcoin, or can be used as a base layer for building decentralized applications, is a testament to misunderstanding what the invention of Bitcoin really was. It was not so much an invention at all, but rather a discovery. The discovery of true digital absolute scarcity. Absolute scarcity, whose most obvious use case was sound money. A discovery is a one-way occurrence. Thousands of people fly from Europe to America every day, but that doesn't make these people as historically significant as Christopher Columbus. Nor will any social network coin, petrodollar, or altcoin ever be as significant as Bitcoin. All right, I can already see quite many things to talk about here, so I'll let you dig in.
Yeah, where do you want to start? Like, you, is it
we need a little bit of focusing here. I think one thing I'll point out is that the focus of this book is very different from I think the tone of discussions now. It's very against cryptocurrency, which is good, but honestly, it feels like everyone now understands that crypto is
the difference. Yeah,
understands the difference, and so there's other things that we're really focusing on in this space. I don't know, any thoughts about that?
I mean, the scams and the scammers are still there, but they're getting cleverer. Like it's like bots on social media. Like they're getting smarter by the day, and it can be harder to understand what that is. It's very hard to say what is a scam and what is not nowadays. Like if you have, for instance, strategy started this trend with, Bitcoin on the balance sheet companies, right? But what people should know, I'm not saying it's a scam because I don't think it's a scam, but I think that scams will follow in its wake where they hold Bitcoin on the balance sheet just to give you something else to invest in than the underlying asset and then be able to do a rug pull at some point. Because like paper Bitcoin is not Bitcoin. Like anything... The ETFs, some of them may be scams, and they might rug people at some point and just sell all the Bitcoin and fuck off somewhere. It's tricky. It's a tricky space to navigate, especially when you're dealing with other things than the actual core protocol and just holding your own keys. If you're dealing with custodial services or things built on top of Bitcoin or beside Bitcoin, there is always a risk involved. I mean, there's a risk involved with the base layer too, but that risk is basically you yourself. Like you not having done your homework is the only risk there. So just be aware of that and do your homework.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the next point I'd like to touch on here then is the discovery of true digital absolute scarcity, whose most obvious use case was sound money. That's vastly important here. Basically. And I think that's at the core of the issues right now. What you talked about earlier, the difference between the devs who are just all about the technical stuff and the implementation and the people who have adopted Bitcoin rightly because it is the best form of money ever conceived. So what's the cause of the problem here? And why is it that the most obvious use case is sound money for Bitcoin?
I mean, Satoshi wrote about this many times. I, by the way, that's a disclaimer. I don't really like using Satoshi's words as some sort of proof that Bitcoin should be this or that. That's sort of what Roger Ver did with the word cash in the white paper, and it's totally misinterpreted that and said like Bitcoin needs to be a medium of exchange over space before anything else. So I don't really like that. But having said that, Satoshi actually wrote about, like, I've tried to make Bitcoin function in such a way that you can make all sorts of transactions, all the monetary transactional types I can think of on the base layer. Multisig, for instance, was one of the things that Satoshi mentioned. But he never said anything about arbitrary data storage, and rightly so, because, like, Bitcoin, when people use it for other purposes than money, then that inevitably leads to Bitcoin being worse as money. And that can be very hard to see. So let me try to explain it. Right now, real estate is being used as money. So people buy houses because the money doesn't work. Fiat money doesn't hold value over time. It does not function as a medium exchange over time, just over space. So what do people do? They buy real estate and stocks and bonds and stuff to secure their wealth into the future. When money, that should really have been a job of money to do that. So Bitcoin comes along and solves that. So like what happens with real estate is that it becomes worse at housing people, at sheltering people from the outside forces of nature, because people don't live in them when they're just stores of value. In an area with expensive beachfront property, it's common that anywhere in the world that a billionaire owns all the houses and the poor people can't afford a single house. So they're pushed out of the market. If we had functioning money that functions as a store of value, both the poor man's problem and the billionaire's problem would have been solved, because the billionaire could hold Satoshis or Bitcoin instead of real estate and just own one or two houses instead of 50, thereby pushing the prices of houses down. And if you denominate in Bitcoin, house prices are going down. So this is, yeah, we'll get into that a lot later about how like shifting your lens and viewing things through Bitcoin is like a great revealer. It's like those glasses in They Live, the Carpenter movie from the 80s, where you can see the world for what it actually is. Anyway, money, when used as other use cases for money, in gold's case, like the industrial use cases and the jewelry use cases, actually make it a worse form of money, because there's demand for it as a consumer good or a production good, and not just a good sui generis, like a good that has one single purpose, that being medium of exchange. Like money should be as clean as possible, because otherwise it's not functioning as well as a medium of exchange. So what happens when Bitcoin becomes arbitrary data storage is that the signals get distorted, and also that the biggest risk is that it might be more expensive in the future to fire up a node because of all of these non-monetary transactions taking up disk space, basically, and the blockchain or the time chain becoming bigger at a faster pace, which wouldn't have happened if this wasn't possible. So there's a lot there to unpack. But the underlying economics of it all is that money that is not only money, but other stuff, is worse at being money. If people understand that, the whole discussion about what to do and what not to do with certain technical aspects of Bitcoin right now would have been much clearer if people just understood that Bitcoin is a monetary network. It was never intended to be anything else. And if it becomes something else, then it won't function as well as money. This is sort of proven by a bunch of shitcoins like Ethereum that tried to be everything, a world computer and blah, 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 and ultrasound money and all sorts of buzzword salad and code salad bullshit. And it's a worse form of money. Like all the quote unquote blockchains that try to do anything else than just be money will lose value over time. In other words, be a worse form of money. And the blockchains that are trying to compete with Bitcoin in being good money will have to be better than Bitcoin, and which means they would have to have a bigger network effect than Bitcoin. They would have to have more people agreeing with them that this is a superior money, which is a losing game to begin with. So any other token in theory would have to differentiate itself from Bitcoin so much so that it doesn't compete with it, or take it on head on, like compete with it. And that's obviously a losing path, because Bitcoin has such a head start, and every good idea is already being implemented on Bitcoin. This is another thing I want to get into later, like how we define good ideas, or differentiate itself from Bitcoin so much so that the other use case doesn't compete with Bitcoin. But there is no other use case for a fucking blockchain, because it's just a slow database. The only reason we need it is to allow for decentralization, which is an unfortunate need, an unfortunate means to a greater end, which is sound money. So it's very unfortunate that we have to have a blockchain. It would have been much better if we could just trust a guy with the ledger. But we can't trust a guy with a ledger. People are printing money. That's so we had to figure out a way to check every transaction, because the only way to check that someone, that there isn't any counterfeiting going on, is if everyone checks every transaction all the time. That's the only way. So that's what Bitcoin is. That's why we need the time chain.
Yeah, and this is a fairly long chapter actually for this book, so I won't linger too long here before moving on. But I think one point here definitely is that it's often not obvious why this is actually important, that Bitcoin being used as some other things is actually bad. Theoretically, the blocks being full sized is actually completely fine. Like if every Bitcoin block was full of monetary transactions, the node runner is getting the same effect that the blockchain is growing at a certain pace, and they're going to need to upgrade their hardware at some interval. That's becoming a lot less relevant, honestly, because the increases are linear and hardware still keeps getting better exponentially at the moment. So that's a much less useful argument. There are other things going on, though, and I don't want to muddle this or get into discussions that are a little too technically deep. And in fact, I think we will have discussions with people who know about this better. But stuff that create more Bitcoin UTXOs, that's a lot worse. Stuff that brings up the fee base, I think that's more where my concerns are at. But the distortion, I think, is one of the key points here, and that people will be disincentivized to use Bitcoin for its monetary purposes if they have to compete with people who are using it for non-monetary purposes and filling blocks up and paying tons of fees. The negative is really self-evident to me, that keeping Bitcoin as sound money is vastly important. But there's a large percentage of the community that doesn't think that this is a problem, basically. That just if fees are paid, that's a monetary transaction. And who cares if it's got arbitrary data?
That's one of the arguments from the other side, so to speak. I saw someone in one of these heated debates about this current thing. Someone posted a picture of the so-called Bitcoin Dominance Index, and which is tracking how Bitcoin fares in comparison to other alternative cryptocurrencies. And I don't like this metric at all, because I think it's insincere. It's giving way too much credibility to the other projects, because you could theoretically just fire up a new cryptocurrency. I sell one to you, Luke, and I charge $10,000 for it. And then there's 10,000 other tokens, and I say my market cap is $100 million. So this whole metric is very hard to verify that anything about it is true. And also, there's that argument then is like, oh, wouldn't it be great if all the other crypto projects just started developing their stuff on Bitcoin? What that argument leaves out is like, no, they wouldn't. They're scammers. All they're doing is like, there are two types of shitcoiners. Like, either you're a scammer or you're a gullible moron. There is no in between. Like, sure, there may be people who do who even develop these things for altruistic reason, but I would put them in the gullible moron category, because they haven't understood that this is not possible. It's not possible to have two different competing finite tokens. Like, makes no sense. So where I'm going with this is like, yes, Bitcoin is for enemies, but that doesn't mean you have to like your enemies. They're still enemies, and they should still be fought as such. And spammers and scammers are your enemies. Sure, Bitcoin is for them too, but please stop doing scammy stuff. I'm still going to fight that.
Anyway, on Bitcoin.
Yeah. Well, not only on Bitcoin. Like, I'm a libertarian, right? I'm an anarcho-capitalist. I believe that people should take responsibility for their own actions. And I believe you should be allowed to run a casino and offer stupid games for people to win stupid prizes from. I don't think any like legislative body should like legislate against that. Like, I don't want the government to stop people from being idiots, because I think people should take responsibility for their own actions. However, two things can be true at the same time. That doesn't mean I have to like scammers. I can still, I am as free as they are to scam people. I'm free to call them out as scammers. So like, yeah, fuck scammers. They're bad actors.
Yeah, but I think that there is a difference between this stuff happening on Bitcoin and scamming in general. We're calling out scamming in general, but it's way worse when it's happening on Bitcoin.
Yeah, Bitcoin is the most important software project in human history, like by far. So like fucking with that deliberately, I am on the autist side. I think it is equivalent to rape, and not only a physical rape, but a rape of like many generations to come. I think it's very bad behavior, and I think it should be at least called out and hopefully fought against with any means we have, any non-violent means we have, because we have to be non-violent. Otherwise, we're just as bad.
Very much so. We could probably keep going quite a bit here, but let's continue and see what other ideas emerge from this chapter. While changing Bitcoin might be really hard, changing the current political state of the world is nearly impossible. Not because of the risk of having your voice drowned out. Everyone on the internet faces that hurdle, but because the game is rigged. It's rigged everywhere. Ignorant bloggers with hubris and a paycheck, often referred to as journalists, often parrot their unseen masters, the central bankers, and accuse Bitcoin of being the biggest pyramid scheme ever known to man. Our current monetary system is a pyramid scheme of such gargantuan proportions that almost everyone on Earth fails to see it for what it is, since the bubble encapsulates the entire planet. Quantitative easing is counterfeiting, and counterfeiting is theft. Wealth is stolen from everyone and given to those most cynical and evil among us. If we had sound money, the playing field would be leveled, and those of us making the most responsible investments would be rewarded. Right now, our current system rewards ignorant demagogues and outright liars instead. A hierarchical system of power will always favor those who crave power above all else. A decentralized system will not. It cannot. It's fair. So, a little more about basically the problem that Bitcoin is helping to solve.
Yeah, this is in manifesto territory, this paragraph. But yeah, that's counterfeiting is the problem that Bitcoin solves. Simple as that. Yeah, and like the last couple of sentences here reminds me of a quote. I think it's a Mark Twain quote. It's always Mark Twain, isn't it? About that, like, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. It might be false. It might be that absolute power attracts those who are already absolutely corrupted. So, like, yeah, there's something to say about that. Bitcoin is completely different. And there's something to say about the discussions now and stuff when you have a leaderless system that is very chaotic. And you have so many, you have almost as many opinions as you have participants in the network. So it's very loud-mouthed and people being rude to one another and a lot of chaos. But that's Bitcoin for you. That's how we have to do things. There is no correct way. We have to figure it out. We have to study this thing and see where it leads. Like, there is no, we interpret Bitcoin rather than like change it. What we can do is like create a momentum in one direction or another, or try to make our voices heard. I mean, it is political in that sense, but what isn't? Like, this is sort of argumentation ethics. Like, human beings have two ways of resolving conflict. One is arguing, and the other one is communication, and the other is violence. And if we don't want violence, which is sort of like, if we don't want leaders to decide how much to counterfeit, then we have to choose argumentation, and that is messy. but it's preferable to aggression always.
Yeah, very good points. I have nothing to add to this one, so I think let's just continue the chapter. According to a recent study in the journal Intelligence, highly intelligent people are more likely to be diagnosed with various mental disorders, such as autism spectrum disorders, 20% more likely, ADHD, 80%, anxiety, 83%, and they have a 182% higher likelihood of suffering from one or more mood disorders. The study compared data from the American Mensa Society to data from national surveys in general. According to another study published a couple of years back in the British Journal of Psychology, highly intelligent people are more likely to have fewer friends than those less fortunate in the cognitive department. In addition to this, many separate studies show that ADHD brains are linked to higher performance in some measures of creativity than their normal counterparts. Having suspected that having a brain on the spectrum runs in my family, both up and down the generations, I dug a little deeper into the subject. I did this mainly because I'm curious about myself and why I function the way I function, but also because of the fact that these diseases were almost unheard of when I grew up. I've done a couple of tests online. They all say I'm quite likely to suffer from one of these conditions, mainly ADD. I've heard preschool teachers voice suspicions about spectrum disorders in one of my kids, and even though I suspect that some teachers look a little harder for these things than they probably should, I wouldn't be surprised if the child's behavior matched more than one of the spectrum condition criteria. A thing that did surprise me, though, was that the Swedish Ministry of Education recently decided to pay extra attention to extraordinarily gifted children. Very unsocial democratic indeed, and probably a sound thought. I became curious and looked at the paper on what behaviors teachers should look for in these children. They were remarkably similar to those who could label another child with ADHD or ADD. So one child gets to skip a class, and another is given amphetamine to be more like the rest of the flock, all depending on the judgment of that particular child's teacher. Ritalin and other amphetamine-like drugs have for a long time been prescribed en masse to children with suspected ADHD and ADD in Western societies. Some countries are more restrictive than others, but these practices are present to some extent almost everywhere. People are being given antidepressants all over the world, and there's an opioid epidemic in the United States. Could it be that we're seeing this from the wrong perspective? What do the institutions and schools have to do with our recent love for mental medication? Here's a scary thought. Are we medicating the wrong segment of the population? Could it be that the less intelligent are unable to understand the behavior of the more intelligent? I'm not saying that everyone on the spectrum is hyper-intelligent, but maybe there's a grain of truth here. Not being able to properly adjust to groups may just be a side effect of preferring to be alone. Not being good at submitting to the will of authorities may be a sign of independence rather than simple disobedience. Imagine if Nikola Tesla or Albert Einstein had been given Ritalin at an early age. Would they ever have come up with the amazing innovations and insights that they did if they'd been medicated into being docile sheep instead? Without the crazy ideas of Tesla, who allegedly was considered a weird loner by his peers, we might not have alternating current, without which the world would be a very different and darker place than it is today. Good ideas propel humanity forward, and we have no idea what we're missing out on by turning our would-be future inventors and scientists into zombies instead. Keeping the ducks in line might seem beneficial to the collective, but it is only the individual that can spawn an original idea. Okay, big turn here, and sort of totally different topic, and a lot said here. So, what were you getting into with this?
This is why you should read Bitcoin: The Inverse of Clown World, because Luke helped me write that, and because of that, it's much more. It takes very much fewer of these sudden left turns, and in comparison to the earlier books. Anyway. What am I talking about here? Yeah, I think the text sort of speaks for itself. That there's something to be said about institutionalized schooling in general. There's a very good Rothbard book called Education Free and Compulsory that I highly recommend. Like, public schooling is an idea from the middle of the 19th century or early 19th century, somewhere around that. And it's basically the idea that we should streamline education, put everyone through the same system so that they can come out the other side, put into these neat little boxes. And you get an engineer there, and you get a lawyer there, and a doctor there, and you can ship them to other parts of the Commonwealth and have them do tasks, like coordinate people and claiming that you are now a doctor, you are now an engineer. And it's then once this institution was in place and public schooling is like everywhere in every country, then it's very hard to make people think outside of that box. And to think of schooling as not as a, maybe not only a positive thing, and I think this chapter is alluding to that, and also this the inflation in the diagnosis of mental disorders that have been on the rise for at least the last decade. There's a lot to be said about it, and yeah, but I think we should just go on and see what the rest of the paragraphs about this say.
Yeah, sounds good. Well, and I mean, I think the just the one point in here is that it's been acknowledged that there wasn't a conception of what these things are, and the increase in diagnoses is something a little bit of that. There's actually a defined metric for saying here's the thing you have, and it's also funny too because deciding to put people into little boxes for the reasons of, hey, you exhibit these symptoms, therefore we must give a name to you, rather than just saying, well, hey, we're all people, we're all individuals somehow. I think that's, mistake is maybe too strong of a word here, but categorizing people based on the list of mental disorders they have is, I think, quite grotesque, honestly.
It is, and it's one of those side effects of collectivism, like poison being the real brain poison here, where like if you are a duck and if you're an ugly duckling and you have problems staying in line with the other ducks, then you're automatically labeled as the as if there's something wrong with you, when that doesn't necessarily have to be the case.
Right. And I mean, I think the secondary negative here is that I don't think it would matter nearly as much if it weren't that, hey, you have a diagnosis, therefore you have an answer, and the answer is some kind of medication. That's definitely the real major negative here. But the thing is that the categorization also has problems with that as well, because in today's age of social media and wokeism, for lack of a better term, people can use their litany of diagnoses as victim points and gain status in the oppression Olympics.
Absolutely, and they open a whole different can of worms. But that is definitely true.
Yeah. So let's continue as you said. But that's just my my thoughts on the matter. This is an important topic, but we cover it more later. And I think for the sake of being a little bit more focused on the changing the rules of it all. We'll continue.
You haven't been taking your pills today, Luke, have you?
No, I haven't. Okay. I don't take any pills.
You take orange ones?
I do take orange ones. I took one.
Do you only take one more, required?
Only one required. Do you keep taking orange pills as your conviction deepen? Is that's not a thing, right? Let's not make that a thing.
I accidentally ate the whole bottle.
Yeah. And now we see what happened with that. Good stuff. Let's continue. Our societies are built upon institutions, and institutions, once in place, have a tendency to act in their own best interest. The people in them have much to lose by not giving in to the will of the machine, so to speak. This includes our schools, in which the children are lumped together for many years with potentially nothing in common but their age. They are then forced to imbibe a curriculum adapted to the median, neatly packed into different subjects, and are then graded by the person most likely to be biased against their talent that exists, the teacher. The internet has long since rendered this system obsolete, but it seems only free thinkers understand that. If anyone should be medicated, it's not the children on the spectrum. Instead of giving these kids mind-numbing drugs, maybe we should try giving everyone else mind-enhancing drugs instead. The sad story about dumbing down the gifted for the sake of the collective is nothing new. The Arab world, for instance, thrived scientifically between the 8th and the 14th century, until the collective interest of religion effectively killed that. Socialist states keep collapsing, Venezuela being the latest tragic addition to this collective madness. Russia threw one of their best thinkers ever, Garry Kasparov, in jail. In short, any society that puts the collective before the individual is on a very dangerous path. Thanks to Keynesian economic theory and central bank counterfeiting, or quantitative easing, all countries are on this path right now. What are the odds that Satoshi was on Ritalin when he wrote the Bitcoin white paper? Yeah, so I think rounding out this topic, and we'll be back to the main scheduled programming after this. But did you have any last thoughts here, Knut?
No, I mean, this is to be taken with a grain of salt. I'm not advocating for drugs here, really. I'm sort of like more saying that drugs shouldn't be enforced on people. Like, nothing should be enforced on people. And putting kids into large groups only based on their age might not be the best idea ever. It's definitely an idea that should come under more scrutiny than it does, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'm not sure there's too much more to say about this. I like the point about mind-enhancing drugs from the perspective of that we shouldn't be prescribing them. I definitely disagree with that, but there maybe should be some more knowledge and understanding about the substances that are available to people and the ways they can be used. Caffeine is probably the biggest mind-enhancing drug out there at the moment. Just the increase in energy. A lot of people can get a lot more things done, and that's pretty good. Creatine is actually a surprisingly very good mental clarity enhancer, and that's good. We've had someone on who believes nicotine is very good for or at least has beneficial effects, and maybe let's not open that exact can of worms, but there's even arguments that alcohol or marijuana are mind enhancing to get into a more creative mental state. But it's interesting. I think all of these things have to be taken in moderation with a grain of salt, and it's also interesting that all of these things are more natural to some extent. These drugs that are crafted in the realm of the pharmaceutical industry for ultimately getting profits to the pharmaceutical industry, there's rampant incentive abuse able to happen there. And if people are making tons of money off of something, well, maybe look at what their motivations might be.
Absolutely. And once again, two things can be true at the same time. You can be totally for that each and every person gets to decide whatever they put in their bodies, because it's a victimless crime. And at the same time, not do it to yourself if you don't feel the need to. And I'm in that camp. Like, I think the vices I do have are already they're enough. Like, I already have caffeine, and I used to have nicotine, but and that was hard to rid myself of. So, like, and alcohol, maybe to a certain extent, you could lump that in there with things that you ought to do more or less of. Very few people think that self-diagnose that it would probably be good for them to do more alcohol in the future. But yeah, you do you. I think that's the gist of it.
Very good, very good gist of it here. And let's take this thing home. We've only got one more paragraph here, but I think we're back to the main topic, which is positive. Yeah. Let's continue. Changing the rules of any game is always hard when you're a participant rather than a game designer. The game you're in is rigged, and you're a pawn on someone else's chessboard. a pawn whose main purpose is to be sacrificed in order to protect the king. Now, look at how the artificial intelligence algorithm AlphaZero plays chess. The newly crowned ultimate chess player does one specific move a lot more often than any of its predecessors. It sacrifices pawns. Ask yourself, are you happy with being a pawn? Does your government's promise of a social safety net seem legitimate to you? Will your current job even exist in 20 years? In 10? You don't need to be a pawn. More importantly, you don't need to leave the game entirely. Even a very small investment in Bitcoin has an enormous potential upside. The Lightning Network is a technology that changes the rules of what money is and what money can be. Once you have a Lightning Network wallet installed and topped up with some Bitcoin on your phone, you quickly realize that it's even easier to use the Lightning Network than it is to use the basic Bitcoin network. You scan a QR code and press send. That's it. Transactions on the Lightning Network are instant, free, and anonymous. Even though it's still in beta at the time of writing, it works like a dream. Imagine what you can build when money can flow through pipes like water or even energy. Circuits that run on value instead of electricity. Logic gates made electronics possible rather than mere electrics. Value gates would open up a whole new spectrum of invention where human interaction would act as fuel for human ingenuity directly. Interesting conclusion. What did you mean by this?
There's a lot to be said for the about the chess analogy with Bitcoin. Like I think the rules of chess are very analogous to the rules of Bitcoin. There is no like leader in chess who decides what the rules of chess are. They have evolved over the ages through consensus amongst the players. And sure, you can play on a chessboard. You can move the pieces however you want and play other games than chess, but you won't have as many other players to play against. So there's it's very similar to Bitcoin in that sense. And the last change to the rules of chess was like in the 11th century. It's a move called en passant. And That's been around for like 900 years or something. Or maybe I'm wrong here, maybe it was it has been around for 1100 years and it was like around the year 900. Either way, it's mind boggling that it has been around for almost a millennia. So and I think the chess analogy is perfect. Like you can play Bitcoin, which is the original chess, or you can play chess cash, where the chessboard has the same amount of pieces, but it's a 64 times 64 squared board. You can play chess theorem, where the rules change with every move. And you can play chess Nero, where no one knows how many pieces there really are. And like all of these are analogous to all the shitcoins. So I love the chess analogy, and we'll go into that more in later books, I think.
Let me actually correct... Let's be correct about exactly what happened with the chess analogy, because it's better. It makes it better to have the exact timeline here. Theoretically, the en passant rule was not adopted at any one specific date. Sometime between the 13th and the 16th century is when advancing a pawn two squares was introduced to speed the games up. But en passant was not realize that was needed, basically, to correct a tactical imbalance. So that rule appears to have been introduced sometime in the aftermath of that, the 13th to 16th century. Okay. And it appeared in chess books around that time. But it was adopted at the latest in about the 1880s by some chess associations, which means it was adopted in a decentralized manner, and it had to be adopted by multiple groups to achieve consensus, basically.
I stand corrected, Luke, on the timeline, but the analogy still works perfectly, right? It is consensus rules. Like, it is people in a decentralized manner coming up with an idea together. And
exactly.
I love it. And the AI stuff here, it's a bit of a a stretch maybe, that sacrificing pawns is that's not as good an analogy. And the Lightning Network, if used in an actual self-sovereign manner, it's a bit more tricky than just scanning a QR code. I'm talking about custodial Lightning here, of course, which is still way better than the fucking banking system. You can still do all sorts of stuff on Lightning and then put your Satoshis in cold storage whenever you return home. It's very easy. And if you go to the very last page, what was the last thing there? Yeah, logic gates, this and electronics and stuff. This is, yeah, I don't know if there's anything in this theory. I don't know if I believe this as much as I did when I wrote this book, simply because value is not, it's very different from water in pipes or electrons in wires. Or electrons in cables, because value is first and foremost subjective, and money is not a ruler, and rulerless money is not a ruler either. Money is not a measurement of value. It is a means of signaling value to others, but it can never measure value, since value is subjective. You don't have to buy something just because the price is something. Choice is always involved. So I don't know how these value gates that I talk about here would actually work. So I think this falls into a category of brain farts that I've since come to my senses about, and maybe stuff like that doesn't take up as much time in my head as they used to.
Fair enough. I think I'm going to really not address this much further for that reason. The brain farts are brain farts sometimes. But the chapter as a whole, so kind of three major points here. I think the first point of the chapter about changing the rules, how changes can happen to Bitcoin, I think that's the most important thing here and the most relevant now into this day and age, basically. So I think that's really the most important part of this chapter, and the part that I hope that our listeners take away from this is the mechanism that Bitcoin changes through forking effectively. And in other words, you can make changes to the code all you want, but that doesn't mean anyone's going to adopt it. That's important to understand, and also has implications for the proposed changes being discussed in Bitcoin these days also.
Yeah, and I'd like to make one final point that isn't really addressed here, and that is that one way of looking at these, the enormous threshold needed for Bitcoin to change, like the threshold of people agreeing. Basically, every participant of the network needs to agree that it's a good idea to change it. It's not a democracy. It's you need a super majority every time for anything to change. And that in itself, if you flip that and see it from the other side, that means that Bitcoin can only be changed for the better, at least theoretically, because we all agreed that it was a good idea to change it before it changes at all. So we sort of define what a good idea is by if we agree that it's a good idea or not. If we do that, then Bitcoin can only change for the better. And that in itself is mind-blowing, I think. Having said that, there have been changes in the past that came with a handful of unforeseen consequences. The witness discount in SegWit, for instance, and maybe Taproot came with a bunch of unforeseen consequences. Still, it's still the best mechanism for changing something that ought not to be changed that we have. I think the Bitcoin's consensus rules is still so much better than democratic decisions where just the other side can win after 4 years and just undo whatever the ruling party was doing the 4 years before that. In comparison to democratic decisions, Bitcoin is vastly superior just because it cannot change very easily. This is very much a feature and not a bug. Bitcoin is first and foremost money, and money shouldn't change. It's because money changes that it stops functioning. That's why real estate is being used as money, because the money changed. Someone printed more of it. That's what we're trying to get away from. So changing the rules is, for the most part, not advisable. Another final point, the word ossification comes up in debates about changes to Bitcoin a lot. And the curious thing about that, that I'm thinking about is that we can never know if Bitcoin has ossified or not. There is no objective measure to say that now Bitcoin has ossified, because we cannot predict the future. There is still a scenario where everyone agrees that we should change Bitcoin. So we cannot, with 100% certainty, say that Bitcoin will never change again, ever. There's something there, I think.
Yeah, plenty of good points here. And, well, I think one of the most relevant ones here is that the comparison of Bitcoin and democracy actually is kind of still relevant here. It's just that the threshold needed is higher. But the thing is, since all participants are effectively voting by deciding to adopt something or not, there is a risk of that people just automatically go for what they're told to vote for, or don't even realize what they're voting for by clicking auto update. And so it's also akin to basically people who are glued to the television who do exactly what the media tells them to vote for. That's pretty similar.
No, it is. And like the only threat to Bitcoin, the only attack vector in my opinion is complacency. Like when people stop caring, it stops functioning after a while. And this is, that applies to everything. Like the only problem with humanity is complacency and like people not caring about stuff. That's why we have problems at all in society, I'd say.
And this is simply why we need to remain vigilant. And I think this is a good place to stop, because we will get into many of these ideas more later. And also, we're going to be talking about a lot of these topical issues a lot more lately. And this is actually something that basically I think we're announcing, sort of. Do you want to take that, Knut?
Yes. I'd like to hereby announce our new live show, Bitcoin Infinity Live, that will be firing up here shortly. I believe the first episode is already on Thursday. Is that the case, Luke?
That's the idea, and we've already got the guests lined up.
We have fantastic guests coming for this. The first one is our dear friend Samson Mo, the guitarist of Nevermind. So looking forward to talking to him about this Operaturn stuff and other things.
Ironically enough, this will be released after that live show. But for those who have joined the Academy and are tuning in live, got to hear about it here first. But we do have the first episode that'll be coming up afterwards. We do have a pretty awesome guest lined up for that one, and it's all going to be on the topic of the current Operaturn Bitcoin Core debates, plus a bunch of other things. Basically, doing a show live lets us talk about what's going on in the community now and what are our thoughts of the day, kind of thing. And hopefully you can join. And also, since we've basically been doing these Academy episodes in our morning in Europe, which is mostly my restriction, sort of, we're going to be doing these in the evening, our evening, almost exclusively. And that'll give another group of people the chance to join in the live shows. And of course, these will be available on YouTube and on our podcast feed. Should be the next day, kind of thing. So looking forward to it.
Absolutely.
Good. And I think with that, we can, first of all, just if you're listening to this and you want to get involved, as usual, go to our Geyser page, geyser.fund/project/infinity, to learn more about the Bitcoin Infinity Academy and join us and get involved with the discussions, attend these live if you want. And thank you very much to Plan B Network for sponsoring the Bitcoin Infinity Academy. They're doing fantastic work. You can find out more about them at planb.network. All of the educational initiatives that they're doing, plus the great work that they're doing in terms of conferences, building physical spaces, tons of other stuff. Check them out and see how you can get involved.
Absolutely. And also check out Bitbox, our favorite hardware wallet. It looks like this. And it's a very neat little device. Privacy focused, easy to use. Just a very good hardware wallet, in my opinion.
Perfect. Yeah, we're big fans of Bitbox, so thank you also to them. And so with that, I think this has been the Bitcoin Infinity Academy. Was there anything else you wanted to add, Knut?
Spadoinkle, as usual, Luke. So until next time.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. This has been the Bitcoin Infinity Academy.